The headlines: Russia pounds the cities of Mariupol and Kharkiv on the 42nd day of its offensive in Ukraine as the West prepares more sanctions against Moscow. A key member of the Israeli Prime Minister's party quits the ruling coalition, leaving Naftali Bennett without a parliamentary majority. And China reports over 20,000 new coronavirus cases, its highest daily tally since the start of the pandemic. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: 42 days into Russia's military offensive in Ukraine, there are reports of fresh Russian strikes against the cities of Mariupol and Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials say they're trying to help residents to evacuate Mariupol. The port city remains one of the worst affected areas, with its mayor warning that the situation there has now gone beyond a humanitarian disaster. Calls for evacuation are also underway in the eastern Luhansk region, where an acid tank exploded on Tuesday. Kiev and pro-Russian forces are blaming each other for the incident. Other developments in eastern Ukraine include Russia's bombardment of the city of Kramatorsk, where an empty school was damaged. Meanwhile, Russia says its guards have been targeted in Kursk, a city located on its western border with Ukraine. And the U.S. is sending another $100 million in aid to Ukraine in response to Kiev's repeated pleas for more Western weapons to fight Russian forces. The aid will be used to buy Javelin anti-armor missiles. Earlier this month, Washington said it was providing $300 million in security assistance to Ukraine that included laser-guided rocket systems, armed drones, ammunition, and other equipment. The newest package brings the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of war in late February to over $1.7 billion. Over 25 nations have joined in purchasing and delivering weapons to bolster Ukraine's defenses. The European Commission has proposed new sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine.
We need to increase our pressure further. So today we are proposing to take our sanctions a step further. We will make them broader and sharper so that they cut even deeper into the Russian economy.
The Commission's president said the body is after banning oil imports from Russia and denying Russian ships entry to the EU ports. The announcement caused oil prices to jump further, with Brent North Sea crude and West Texas Intermediate gaining more than 0.5% to end up over $100 per barrel on Tuesday. Ursula von der Leyen said the new sanctions would also include a ban on Russian coal imports. In Germany, the economy minister has said the country would likely have to shut down some of its power plants if it immediately stopped the coal imports. Meantime, the United States and its allies are reportedly considering more anti-Russia sanctions, including against Russian banks and investment in the country. The sanctions would also target Russian government officials and their families. Meantime, Russia is threatening to respond to the sanctions by taking action against countries that violate its rights. Deputy Chairman of the Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says Moscow will fight attempts to seize Russia's property abroad in courts around the world as part of the Western drive to punish Russia with a medley of restrictive measures over Ukraine. Dutch customs authorities have confiscated 14 yachts and shipyards. They say these vessels cannot be delivered, transferred, or exported. For now, Russia is currently the world's most sanctioned country. The Israeli Prime Minister's party has lost its majority in parliament after a key lawmaker quit the ruling coalition. Chairwoman of the ruling coalition, Idlit Silman, has, in a surprise move, resigned over a religious dispute. Her resignation has left the alliance with only 60 seats, effectively ending its parliamentary majority. Opposition figures have welcomed her move. The issue has also raised the possibility of new elections, less than a year after Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's cabinet took office. If that happens, it would be Israel's fifth elections in more than 2 years. Bennett's coalition, which has formed last year to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu, consists of 8 political parties. People in the Gaza Strip are observing yet another month of Ramadan under tough conditions due to the inhumane Israeli siege. Pastor Shannon has more details in the following story from Gaza.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month, while people in Gaza struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food, and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China is recording the highest daily COVID cases since the beginning of the pandemic despite using strict measures. The National Health Commission says it has registered more than 20,000 cases across the country, with Shanghai accounting for more than 80% of the tally. China has been trying to keep the daily cases low by imposing strict restrictions and mass testing. Despite that, there's been a huge increase in new infections in recent weeks, owing to mutation of the Omicron variant. Since then, Shanghai has put all its 26 million residents under lockdown. Nearly 40,000 medical personnel have been deployed to the city to deal with this situation. The medical operation in Shanghai is the biggest since the Wuhan lockdown in early 2020, the city where the first cases appeared. France's presidential election is coming up in less than a week. Early polls and analyses suggest that the race is going to be tighter than expected. Voters will be casting their ballots on Sunday if no candidate wins a 50% majority. The top two will move ahead of a runoff on the 24th of April. The polls are projecting that incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen will advance to the second round in a repeat of their 2017 duel. But this time with a much narrower gap, Macron has promised reforms, calling Le Pen's party a clan with unchanged policies, and Le Pen has downplayed what many refer to as Macron's automatic re-election, saying she's seeking radical political changes. For two decades, no sitting French president has been re-elected for a second term. Well, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, one of Europe's longest-serving leaders, has won a landslide victory in elections held on Sunday. Under Orban, Hungary has repeatedly clashed with the EU over several issues, including the rule of law. We've discussed this, or his victory, and what it would mean for Hungary's relations with the bloc in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. Now, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, one of Europe's longest-serving leaders, has won a landslide victory in elections held on Sunday. His party, Fidesz, won two-thirds of parliament seats, given a crushing defeat to the opposition alliance. Under Orban, Hungary has repeatedly clashed with the EU over several issues, including the rule of law. His fourth consecutive term in office is likely to broaden the crack within the bloc further, with some people labeling Orban's victory as a new headache for the EU. Okay, that's the storyline. Let me invite two guests and ask their opinion regarding this. So, Paola Raffone, Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, is joining me from Brussels. Also with us will be James Twitty, journalist and commentator on international affairs in Plymouth. Welcome, gentlemen. Now, Paola, let's begin with you. So, you just heard the story. So, what's going on in Hungary? The first question is, what made Prime Minister Orban win this again and stay in power, and what would it mean for his country and the EU?
Well, the elections were pretty good, I mean, in terms of procedural handling of it. It has been said also by the OSCE, although there are some systemic problems which existed since the past and remained also during these elections. So Mr. Orban has been elected fully with a landslide vote. And this reinforces his government and his position. And he will continue maintaining the position that he has had towards the EU and the attempt from the EU to accuse Hungary of breaking or not respecting the values of the European Union, including the respect of rule of law. We will see what happens, but it will be anyway a very complicated, slow, lengthy discussion between the Hungarian government and the Brussels authorities, which will take months to materialize in anything concrete.
Okay, James, let's hear your side of the story. And why should Orban be a headache for the EU?
Well, he's broken ranks with the EU on a number of issues, but this is why he's been re-elected, I think. The election, of course, happened a month after the war in Ukraine began, and Orban's government refused to follow the other European Union countries and NATO countries, you know, Britain and the US, including Britain and the US, in putting sanctions on Russia and generally being aggressive towards Russia. And as a result, Hungarians are not facing the same problems of their, you know, household energy bills going up by 50% or 100%. And they, you know, they don't really have to live in fear of being press ganged into the war in some way, you know, if it escalates any further and NATO gets involved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously these are obvious reasons why he's won. Now, the European Union likes to talk about European values, which they, you know, claim to, they claim anything, you know, it is what the European Union defines it as, and they claim a kind of monopoly on them, that they have, you know, that those values are exclusively European and the rest of the world doesn't have those values, like democracy or something, you know. So, yes, and any country that kind of turns away from the political agenda of the centralized political agenda of the EU, of course, gets condemned, like Poland has been, the Czech Republic has been, and Hungary. Okay. Hungary has not allowed people trafficking on its territory, for instance, which has limited the flow of whether you call them refugees or asylum seekers or economic migrants to Germany, mm-hmm. but Germany wants economic migrants. Hungary is not participating in this economic war on Russia either. So, of course, it's being denounced as some kind of dictatorship in the heart of Europe.
Right, Paolo, we've been seeing this happening in Europe with the rise and emergence of some candidates, contenders, and political figures from the far right. Now we have Marine Le Pen in France, for instance, in a tight race with incumbent Macron, and then we have also Orban there in Hungary. What's behind the rise of these rightist figures in Europe?
Well, first of all, there is a tradition, because Europe has been traditionally a conservative political space with tendency to some kind of rightist type of government. So it's not a big surprise. The surprise is the left in Europe, which is something usually not in the majority, and instead we have a majority now of governments leaning on the left. So this is not a big deal. I mean, and then to call them extreme right or extreme left, I mean, this is something for the media to play with. In fact, these are consolidated conservative groupings that are trying to defend the identity of their nations, proposing alternative ways to be together in a European space, which is not under this strict EU-controlled umbrella. And this sentiment is quite spread around Europe. I mean, we are talking about Hungary and France now, but in Poland is the same situation. And it's quite interesting that Poland was accused of violating the rules on rule of law, but now nobody's saying it again because Poland is so necessary in the war in Ukraine. But Hungary is put again under the hotspot of the European Commission. So, you know, this is a sentiment which is quite normal in Europe and not necessarily goes to the far right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for your input and contribution. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation in Brussels. James Twitty, journalist and commentator on international affairs in Plymouth.
In Sri Lanka, the government has been facing widespread protests against its handling of the worst economic crisis in decades, but President Gotabaya Rajapaksa has no intention to resign. A cabinet minister says the president won't quit under any circumstances. Meanwhile, doctors have joined the chorus of discontent with the government by holding protests. They say the entire health system is on the verge of collapse due to shortages of medicine. Earlier, President Rajapaksa revoked a state of emergency after 41 lawmakers quit the ruling coalition, leaving the government in a minority. On Monday, he dissolved the cabinet in hope of forming a unity government, but his newly appointed finance minister resigned after only a day in office. The opposition has also rejected entering a coalition with the government and is calling for the president to resign. To stay afloat and get itself out of the economic quagmire, Sri Lanka has few options outside of turning to the International Monetary Fund. The island nation has so far received 16 IMF loans since it joined the financial institution back in 1950. But opinions are divided on whether it should go for yet another IMF loan, as many believe such international lenders to be the root cause of economic crises in countries like Sri Lanka. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
team two.
Two man.
Yani?
Bazaar. Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, the oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil. Hello once again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This time we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique. So let's start the show. Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Saze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services. The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and off land. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more. Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services. One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality. Here's a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from the removal of sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed. As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas. And Iran makes a large amount of both. Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year, nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity. The world's first electric elevator was built by a German inventor nearly 150 years ago, marking the beginning of the world's history of the electric elevator industry. But the idea of using lifting mechanisms dates back to more than 10,000 years ago. The first known lifters were in fact wells, elevators and escalators have had a big impact on modern architecture and design. Through the innovation of these two travel systems, we are able to effortlessly move through multiple levels quickly. This technology has changed the way we travel through the buildings we encounter every day. This week, we will be talking about Iran's elevator and escalator market. To familiarize ourselves with how elevators are made, we visited the production facilities of Behran Asambar in the industrial town of Parand near Tehran. With over 30 years of experience, it specializes in making elevators, escalators, and industrial lifts. It also manufactures lift gearboxes and gearless motor drives as well as other important parts. This company has made a name for itself through products that create harmony between a practical and aesthetic design, which also offers safe and quiet rides for passengers. This company has implemented hundreds of projects, many of them you probably have already heard of. Some of these are Imam Khomeini International Airport, Tehran Subway System, Iran's Parliament, and the list goes on and on. From its humble beginnings, this company has expanded its manufacturing over the years and now has a production hall with an area of over 110,000 square meters. In addition to manufacturing full lift and escalator packages, this company provides its 14,000 customers of various types with parts and components. Moreover, it is a trusted representative and agent of some known foreign brands as well. Among its many services, this company offers consultations, installation, and after-sales services to its customers. Roughly 1,200 people are employed at this company. Many of them are experts in designing products that seemingly integrate with any project's unique environment. Here is a fun fact about elevators. Each day, elevators move around some 330 million passengers around the world. In other words, all elevators combined together carry the equivalent of the Earth's entire population every 3 days. This also means elevators and escalators are more frequently used than other forms of transportation. That is why their demand remains high, both nationally and internationally. While this company is broadly known inside Iran, it is internationally active as well. It has official representative offices in Iraq, Syria, and Armenia, as well as permanent international offices in countries including Oman, UAE, Germany, and Turkey. But that's not all. This company has implemented hundreds of large projects in several countries, including Azerbaijan and other neighboring nations. The quality control department at this business holds the pulse of the company. Here, new products are designed and existing products are improved on. One of the most important activities in this department is quality control. The output of all stages of production undergoes stringent quality controls that begin with checking the raw material. This includes repeated safety checks to ensure nothing goes wrong with the final product. It also has a test tower with necessary knowledge-based mechanisms for testing its various packages and parts. This company received its operation license from the Ministry of Industry. Additionally, it has received certificates from the National Standard Bureau as well as other international standardization organizations. Among its future goals, this knowledge-based company is planning on expanding its product portfolio as well as its export market. Over the years, this company has faced numerous challenges to enjoy its many achievements. One such obstacle has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. It has viewed this issue as an opportunity to strengthen its business and fill a market void. Probably
probably the biggest customer of the escalator and elevator industry is the construction sector. Demand for this industry is largely based on trends in the construction sector and downstream activity. Companies such as the one we just mentioned have indigenized productions of lift technology and reduced dependency on imports while saving the country billions. The electric elevator industry in Iran is roughly 80 years old and began when the first oil refinery was built in the southern city of Abadan. And now, this sector is thriving. The Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industry says the country has the capacity for producing and commissioning 80,000 elevators annually. But only 25,000 units are currently produced each year due to the stagnation of the construction industry. The highest level of elevator production and installation in the country was recorded in 2014. This was mainly due to the boom in the construction of Meh housing units. The project was a large-scale construction program that was launched in 2007 to provide 2 million low-income Iranians with housing units. During the heyday of this massive nationwide project, nearly 75,000 new elevators were installed. Such productions pushed Iran to be ranked as third in the world in terms of elevator demand after the United States and China. That's all based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries.
There are plenty of construction projects being carried out all across West Asia. The government has targeted neighboring countries to increase its elevator market reach. Some of these countries include Armenia, Iraq, and Syria. Parallel to this, it is also supporting ways to strengthen the infrastructure for increased production of elevators and escalators.
Towards this goal, the government is encouraging collaborations between research institutions and other knowledge-based companies in this field. By increasing technical know-how through scientific research, companies can stay up-to-date and relevant in the highly competitive market. Right now, the domestic demand for elevator and escalator sales and installation stands at roughly 50,000 per year. Presently, there are a total number of 750,000 operating elevators in the country, which move around 250 million people daily. That's based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries. On another note, Tehran's subway system is the biggest consumer of escalators in the country. However, many of the lifts and escalators in the system need to be upgraded or overhauled entirely. Currently, about 1,200 escalators are active in various subway stations across the capital. While Iran is a major producer of elevators, it still needs to further develop its escalator productions as most of its technology is still being imported. All things considered, there is so much investment potential in this thriving sector, which promises a bright future.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear colleague and friend out on the field who has prepared an interesting feature program for you. Let's go check it out.
Northern Iran consists of the southern border of the Caspian Sea and the Alborz Mountains. It includes three major provinces, Gilan, Mazandaran, and Golestan. This region enjoys annual precipitation ranging from 600 millimeters to 2,000 millimeters. The lush green Caspian region is home to 80 species of tree and 50 species of shrubs. Every year, Iran exports more than 2,300 tons of flowers and plants to 23 countries. The Islamic Republic annually exports some $15 to $20 million of its flora and plants. And today, we are in Mazandaran province to visit a company that produces ornamental trees and flowers. Cultivation of various ornamental plants due to the favorable climate of Iran and the income from their exports can play a significant role in development of Iran's national production. Iran is one of the only countries in the world which is the complete four seasons, which has made it possible to produce most flowers in the country. If this indigenous capacity of Iran is at rest, not only can Iran fulfill domestic needs, but also it can have a stronger presence in the global market. The company plans to transfer to Nashtarud in western Mazandaran province next month. Nashtarud is a perfect place for planting ornamental flowers and plants and could turn into the center of ornamental flowers and plants production in Iran.
For our final portion of the program, let's dive right into it and take a brief look at some news and trends in Iran's oil and gas industries. Industry participants say Iran is nearly self-sufficient in the field of producing technology necessary for the oil and gas sector. Now, an Iranian company is set to commercialize a multi-phase pump used in the oil industry. The Iran-made pumps will be used to transport oil and gas on fields. These multi-phase pumps are becoming popular among operators around the world as a tool for more economical and environmentally friendly oil and gas transport. The idea is to flow and pressure boost the raw well stream before the processes of separation and treatment of the product.
With the help of Iranian engineers, another area that the country has reached full self-reliance is maintenance and repairs of offshore oil platforms.
In the past, platforms were sent to other countries for repairs. Now, it's done domestically and has saved the country roughly $6 million for each rig. There are tens of drilling rigs off the Persian Gulf and Sea of Oman, which has been built and installed by domestic knowledge-based companies. Drilling equipment has also been indigenized.
Seismic exploration studies carried out in the Caspian Sea region have led to key discoveries, adding to Iran's proven oil and natural gas reserves.
Results of the study showed the likely presence of a massive hydrocarbon formation in Iran's northern Gorgan Plain. The exploration included drilling 20 wells in the region near the border of Turkmenistan in Golestan province near the Caspian Sea. Preliminary findings detected that the gas field holds some 3 trillion cubic meters of natural gas, making it the world's 10th largest gas reservoir.
Well, that covers our program for today. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al Uzma, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So we were talking about how we are able to have that financial sustainability and the importance of us doing something and not being lazy and all these other things. And then I said that there were these recommendations of how we need to be independent. And I did mention a hadith. I just wanted to comment on the hadith which I mentioned from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi about the negative sides of accumulating money and not doing your obligation towards it. And then I mentioned that the perishing of the women of my ummah is in two red things, al-dhahab wal-thiyab al-riqaq. And then I said that al-riqaq is tight, but the correct understanding is al-thiyab al-riqaq means see-through clothes. It should be see-through clothes. And then, of course, the rest of the hadith, which is relevant to us, even the beginning of the hadith where Rasulullah says that dhahab. Why did he say dhahab? You know, because women might want to accumulate a lot of dhahab. That's their way of being engrossed in the dunyawi material kind of things. And maybe the man, in his sense, is jam'ul ma'al. And that's the burden of the negative side of accumulating money and not doing their wajib acts. Anyway, it is an interesting hadith, which is why Sheikh Jawadi Amuli mentions it here. And it does allude to how money can be a fitna for us. It can block us from progressing spiritually and morally. Again, we need to remember that we have to find that balance, you know. And in these ahadith, we can really see that balance that exists, you know. The last hadith I mentioned in the previous episode was from Imam Sajjad, where he says, "Istithmarul mal tamamul muru'a," that the best form of chivalry is the investing of your money. So when you say islahul mal or istislah, as I had mentioned, it means that you're working your money, you're doing something, you're expanding, you're building your finances, which is a very good thing. Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions there are four different important goals that we can see from an Islamic perspective about how important it is for you to expand, financially expand, and manufacture as well. You know, stop importing and try to have something of your own. And that itself will bring about a lot of very, very good benefits. Point number one that he mentions is it will give you honor, it will preserve your dignity, it will allow you to be independent and not in any needs of anyone else. Number two, that it will expand in your reasonable facilities that you need and your comfort and your welfare for yourself, for your family members, for the community around you. Number three, it will also enable you to honor and respect and help and assist your extended family, your kin.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Number four, you will be able to spend for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in removing the financial needs of individuals and people in the community. So these are four things that Sheikh Jawadi Amali mentions about how good it is to have islahul mal. And as I said, islahul mal is financing your money or having good finances in such a way where you are expanding financially and you're also building something for yourself and for everyone who is around you. And that's what we mean by the good goals of manufacturing. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, "Man talaba ar-rizq fi ad-dunya isti'fafan 'an an-nas wa tawsi'an 'ala ahlihi wa ta'attufan 'ala jarihi laqiya Allah 'azza wa jalla yawm al-qiyamah wa wajhuhu mithlu qamar laylatal Badr." Whoever pursues, whoever goes after rizq in this dunya, if you're going after, you're running after money in this dunya, but for the sake of keeping people chaste, keeping people pure, and to accommodate for your family and to sympathize with your neighbor, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you'll be meeting God and your face is like a full moon. وَوَجْهُهُ مِثْلُ الْقَمَرِي لَيْلَةَ الْبَدْرِ. لَيْلَةَ الْبَدْرِ means on the 15th day of the 15th of the lunar month, which basically means a full moon. And there are many of these ahadith that also speak about, you know, how you are able to expand, how bad it is for you to rely and not be lazy and things like that. The Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when he comes across these cases, he says that it's these kind of people who I hate. Inni la'abghadhu ar-rajulu farighan fah ila rabbih. I'll read that hadith. Let me just get to this point first. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, again talking about how good it is for you to pursue money in the positive way, you know, and that's why we need to find that balance. A man said to Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, "Wallahi, by Allah, I swear by God, we seek this dunya, we pursue this dunya, and we love for something to come out of it. We love money to come to us. We love dunya to come to us." فقال إمام الصادق عليه السلام قال تحب أن تصنع بها ماذا. What do you want with this money? You know, what are you going to do with this? You know, you're saying that you love all this stuff. What do you want to do with it? قال, this person said, أعود بها على نفسي وعيالي وأصل بها. I'm going to use this money to preserve myself and my family members. And then I am also going to use it for silatul rahim, asilu biha, to make sure that I observe my kin. And I also pay charity with it. And I do hajj with it. And I do umrah with it. We'll continue on in the next episode, inshallah. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents
a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.